Hey, it's Mason, and welcome back to Anime Attic. This is the show where we go into our attics and blow the dust off of old, forgotten anime that people don't really know about anymore or don't follow and doesn't get promoted, but there's so much good stuff that it's just awesome and worth it to bring it back and then talk about it and hopefully get some more people aware and able to see it. Today with me is...
Hi, it's Zara.
And Zara is a amazing Hollywood voice actress and also a noted Japanese theater scholar and, I don't know, just awesome person overall.
Oh, Mason, you flatter me.
Yes, I try. And today we're going to talk about one of my absolute, positively amazing, most favorite animes ever that I wish more people knew about. It's Vampire Princess Miyu, and if I can get specific, it's Vampire Princess Miyu, the original video animation, the OVA series. Originally, it was an OVA. It started as an OVA, and then it became a manga, and then it became a TV series that ran for 26 episodes. But in each iteration of those, it changed slightly, and I was introduced in the OVAs, and they literally changed my life. There are four episodes, and the art direction, the music, the character design, the voice acting in Japanese was so mind-blowing.
We'll talk about the dub later.
Yeah, I mean, the sub versus dub debate is intense, but here's some evidence on my side. I'm a sub guy, a subtitle guy. Anyway, but let me start talking about it. Zara, any thoughts in general?
Oh, I had never seen any of this before, the OVA, the series, or read the manga. So I was just so excited to watch Vampire Princess Miyu for the first time. So for me, you know, it came out 1987?
Yeah, it came out in 1988, and it was by a husband and wife team. The director was Hirano Toshiki. I think he changed his name, but it's
Hirano Toshiki.
And he's a famous anime director who did a lot of his own projects, but this was a passion project that he did. And then his wife, who also was the character designer and the lead artist, was Kakinochi Narumi. And this catapulted her career. She did the character designs on this, and then everybody was like, these character designs are beautiful, and we want to hire you for all this other stuff. And to briefly talk about it, I found out while doing research for this episode that primarily they started in Lemon forms, a very softcore adult hentai stuff.
Oh, the creators did?
Yeah.
Oh.
Which that's like where they started. They started running a softcore adult Lemon manga.
Not to be confused with Lemon Party.
Right. I don't know. Do you know why it's called Lemon? I have no idea.
I'm not sure.
All right. I didn't know if maybe you'd come across that. The other thing that I discovered was, they ran in a manga called Lemon People. Anyway, this series, I have always had a soft spot in my heart for vampires. I find that most people in the world kind of break down into two camps, or I guess maybe three. So there's vampires and zombies and werewolves. And usually people are kind of more passionate about one of those.
Vampires, zombies, or werewolves.
Yeah. I always use this analogy. Someone comes up to you and says, hey, do you want to be in a film? And people are like, nah, you know, I don't know about that. You know, you're a sketchy, arty guy. Like, you know, maybe it's going to be a bad movie. And then you're like, oh, it's a vampire movie. And they're just like, how much money do you need? Like, I want to be in it right now. Or you say, or these days, it's a zombie movie. Mm-hmm. And then you're just like, yeah, I'll take off of work for that. And then you're like, all right, great. And then it's like, or it's a werewolf movie.
So totally. Or like getting people jazzed to see a certain genre. Like, I don't give a flying feline about zombies. But if someone says, hey, watch this vampire thing, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm into that. Blood. Cool.
Right, right. Yeah. This is what I'm talking about. So Vampire Princess Miyu already had a leg up on me on that. And I saw it, I want to say like 20 years ago.
Wow.
And it literally shaped my life. I was so deeply influenced by the art design and the character design and the use of sound effects. The sound design in this anime is amazing. If you don't watch this anime for any other reason, I recommend just checking out the sound design. There are sound effects in it, which I found out for budget reasons were basically stock versions, stock sound effects in Japan. And so a bunch of different animes use them. But I've never seen any of them used to such masterful effect as I did in the Vampire vs. Mew, the OVAs. The sound effects are used so wonderfully. And then later, my friends and I would watch just anime in general, anything else. And a sound effect that we'd heard before would come up and we'd say, oh, that's a Mew sound effect. You know, and it became kind of a game that we would do. We would always like listen. And if there was a sound effect that was from Mew, because there are, there's a lot. There's the pouring water. There's the screechy metal. There's the breaking glass. There's the wooden... I can't remember the name of that one, but or there's the bamboo filling in with the water and then tipping into the bucket or whatever. And the pouring water, I think I already mentioned that. Anyway,
a lot of water and blood, water liquid and blood, energy.
Yeah, so, I was going to say that's why.
Yeah.
Anyway, but Sarah's right. The reason that this is such a great episode is because it is a vampire series. And it focuses on a girl who's a vampire, and she basically is... So there are these creatures called Shinma, which are part god, part demon, and they're kind of evil or whatever. But they used to be constant in ancient times. That's where you get all these tales of Babylonian gods being giant monsters that eat everyone. And they decided to relinquish the earthly world to the humans, and they went into this place called the Dark, which is essentially another dimension, and they slumber there. And Mew is a half Shinma, half human. So she's, you know, kind of like Blade, you know, half vampire, whatever. But she's from a line of Shinma that were designated to be defenders.
Guardians.
Guardians, yeah. Guardians of the Shinma so that the Shinma don't wake up or their sleep is undisturbed until the proper time. And so what ends up happening is if a Shinma does wake up and get into the earthly world, she's tasked with hunting it down and either killing it or returning it to the Dark. One of the ways that she does this is she has a companion with her named Larva.
Larva.
Yeah, who is this very attractive man.
Very attractive, even though he wears a mask most of the time.
Yeah, but the mask is
so
cool.
The mask makes him attractive.
Yeah, it's so cool. I love
strong, silent type.
Yeah, well, his voice was sealed away, which I thought was a wonderful cost-saving measure from a production
Touché.
Standpoint. Yeah, I think one of the reasons that I'm so impressed with this anime is they did it on apparently a super, super tight budget. Mm-hmm. And it's better than a lot of the stuff.
And you can tell that it's done on a super tight budget, but it doesn't detract from it. The simplicity adds to it.
Yeah, because that's like the vibe of the whole thing. It's all very simple. And the writing is fantastic. There's four episodes to the OVAs. Every episode is essentially a morality play, which I've always been very intrigued by morality plays because when you start getting into the gray areas of what's right and what's wrong, it really makes you think. And I think that the entire point of film and literature and stories is to get people to think, to reevaluate what they currently know and to either upgrade it or change it or
to ask yourself the hard questions.
Yes. And one of the things that I think Mew does excellently is just that. Like one of the basic questions is, so Mew as a vampire can grant eternal life. If you are a human and you willingly offer her your blood, which you want to because she's super hot, even though she's like, I don't know, 14.
13.
Or so. 13. But
I don't know if she's super hot, Mason. But
the mystique.
All
the
right.
Mystique.
All right.
I, you're right.
To each their own.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Whatever, you like Akio. but she's a very strong female character. She's wise beyond her years because she is like, I don't know, 200 years old or something.
Well, that's an interesting question, actually. We'll get this when we talk about her origin story, which that last episode deals with origin is so great. I was having trouble understanding when that came about. Like, I read it happened in post-World War II Japan.
Yeah.
But then another account says, oh, it happened in like... pre-war empire Japan?
Yeah, there's different versions. There's the TV version and the OVA version and then the manga version. I don't know. You can kind of take your pick. I think the OVA version is post-World War II.
Because it interacts with my favorite character of the show, Himiko.
Yeah.
It crosses over with her back.
Yeah, so let's get into it. So what I'd like to do is talk about each episode. There's four episodes, and the first thing that I noticed when I first watched it was that each episode represented a season. So it starts in summer and then goes to fall and then goes to winter and then goes to spring. And I thought that was a wonderful visual representation of just the story, because in each episode you learn different aspects of Mew. But yeah, it all starts with Himiko, who is a spiritualist.
A spiritualist, sort of a paranormal investigator slash healer.
Yeah, and the way that the OVAs work is that she gets invited or asked to do these jobs.
Mm-hmm. Which she doesn't make a lot of money doing it. I love how that's her opening speech. She's like, it's hard making a living at this kind of work, but...
Yeah, because it's so obscure. Like, who hires a spiritualist in these days? But yeah, I also liked it because it was kind of a really good introduction for the audience. If you don't know anything about spiritualism or mysticism, particularly Asian mysticism or spiritualism, like here was your character that you could follow, and she kind of explained everything. And then by contrast, how Miyu played against everything that she knew.
Yes, ethically as well.
As well, which is awesome. I mean, that goes into the morality play.
I also just want to point out that it's set in Kyoto, the first three episodes.
Yeah.
Which is the traditional capital of Japan. And so much of, you know, when you think about religion and spirituality and mysticism, you think about Kyoto. And so we'll talk about that later, how the Kyoto is a good backdrop for these paranormal stories.
Yeah, no, I'd love to talk about that.
So it's in Kyoto. It's in the summertime.
Right. And it starts with a vampire attack. There's a vampire who attacked a girl in a park. And, well, that doesn't really summon Himiko, but... What, there's a girl who pricked her finger on a rose and fell asleep for 100 days, and the parents have the parents have summoned Himiko, but when she arrives in the middle of this vampire that's attacking random women.
Yeah. Oh, how subtle and cool was that dress? So one of the vampire's victims is this woman who works in a kimono shop. And essentially she hears like a rustle. She turns around. We have a still frame of the window because they don't have the budget to animate it.
Right. Well, a car drives by.
The window cracks, and then they flash to her lying dead on the ground. And with no spectacle, they just move to it. So, you know, I just thought that was so cool, and it really caught me off guard.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very shocking, and it was very effective, because I was like, wow, that's supernatural. That's awesome. You didn't hear anything. Mm-hmm. You heard the glass crack. You see the glass crack, and then boom, she's gone, and the guy comes back.
Shop owner guy?
The shop owner guy. The kimono shop owner guy was like, I'll be right back, and then he leaves, and then boom, it happens, and he comes back. He's like, oh my God, and then it's the police, and they're like, whoa, her body's been drained of blood. That's effective storytelling, man. Mm-hmm. Like, good job. So into all of this, Himiko comes and she goes and investigates the little girl who is asleep. Himiko realizes that she is possessed. It's legit. And she identifies it as a fox spirit, which was really cool to me because I'd never, at the time that I was watching it, other cultures' mysticism had never entered my purview. I was a Western guy, an American. I knew about ghosts and vampires from my point of view, but I'd never seen any from Japan or anything like that. It never occurred to me that, oh yeah, there's other culture. Oh yeah, like, there's other aspects that you can take on this. I mean, obviously in today's internet world, you know, culture cross permeates everything. But
this was pre-internet. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pre-internet for sure. And well, it was BBS. You could dial up boards on dial up and download JPEGs. That would take 10 minutes or something.
Man.
But one of the things that I thought was really interesting was Miyu had gold eyes. That was apparently a Japanese vampire trait. If you're a vampire, you have gold eyes. And if you watch the OVA, she has gold eyes, but only when she's about to feed. Or when she's in vampire form. When she's in her schoolgirl or normal form, she has brown eyes. Because if you look at the gold eyes and you're a victim, you get transfixed.
Mm.
But that plays into episode 4, where she tries it on Himiko and it doesn't work. And the question is, why not? And that's kind of a hint
as to what happened between them.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah, it's so good. It's great. And I definitely want to give a shout out real quick to the voice acting. The voice acting was amazing in the OVAs. Miyu is voiced by Naoko Watanabe, and she's just amazing. She is hands down this ageless, wise, capricious vibe of delivery that just perfectly captures the character of Miyu. Miyu is essentially a 13-year-old girl, although she's wise beyond her years and has kind of been stuck around for who knows how long. And then Himiko, the woman who plays Himiko, is Mamie Koyama, is amazing as well. Like, I can't deny that. And Shinma Ranka, which, well, we'll get into that in episode two. But anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so Himiko, she goes to see the sleeping girl, and she determines that she is possessed, but she can't wake her up, so she leaves. And then while she's
leaving...
And
she apologizes to the parents, too. And she's like, I can't take money because I failed in doing this.
Exactly. I'll forego my fee, which I thought was a classy move, Himiko. Like, good job.
It's good establishing her as sympathetic, too.
And also, like, honest.
Yeah. Like, you instantly like her.
Yeah, I do. She's very practical. I was... For some bizarre reason, I really bonded with her coming in from the airport.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, she comes in from the airport and...
To see people that aren't moving.
Right, of course.
It's a pan across
and,
a
yeah,
stuff.
And, but it's tinted because she's wearing sunglasses. Ah. And then she takes it off.
We are literally the audience through her view.
Yeah, like, POV.
We're her point of view.
Yeah, she's like, oh man, it's really hot. And then this cab is like, hey, how about a ride? But of course, not moving. It's just a it's just a horn honk. And she checks her wallet and she's like... All right, I'll do it.
Like, she's so real, y'all.
You're real. Like, you're a legit struggling spiritualist, and I'm sorry. And she's very attractive, but I thought it was very interesting that they never deal with any romance. There's no real romance.
There isn't.
For her in this series.
Other than her calling a, you know, 14-year-old boy a cutie.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's coming. We'll talk about that in episode two. But yeah, she's leaving the house that she can't raise the girl from, and she walks outside and there's this boy there, and he's got a knife, and he's like, I'm gonna kill the vampire. And the big reveal is that, spoilers, his girlfriend was the first victim of the vampire, and he saw it go into that house. So he's like, I'm gonna kill it. So she starts talking to the kid, and she's like, yeah, I've been hearing about these vampires that are attacking and what's going on and all this stuff. So he's like, I'm gonna go to the park tonight and I'm gonna hunt the vampire. And she's like, all right, I'll help you. So they go, and they're expecting the vampire, but who they run into is Miu, who is also hunting the vampire because it's a stray Shinma. And I thought, what a fantastic introduction. I mean, she appears, she's on top of the arch, she's got Larva with her.
And she like jumps in and saves, like, is it she or Larva who jump in? Like, the vampire's about to suck Himiko's blood. Like, the vampire's about to attack her.
Oh,
remember?
Yeah.
And then all
You're
of a
right.
sudden...
It's both of them. Larva jumps in and,
Larva
and like
jumps in
cuts
yeah.
his, cuts the Shinma's cape or whatever. But but Miu's kind of overwatching everything. And is like, and then she like taunts Himiko.
Yeah.
And she's like, I really don't think you should get more involved in this. And you know, and it's just, it's a younger girl taunting an older woman. And it's a very interesting dynamic. And one of the things that I love about this OVA series is the dialogue is so on point. Like, and the voice acting really delivers it super, super well in the Japanese version. And I really admired that. I thought Miu gave a wonderful sense of agelessness and wisdom. You instantly want to believe everything she says. And you also get the sense that she's incredibly powerful and supernatural. That you're kind of, when you're dealing with her, you're kind of in this other dimension. I admired that. I was very charmed by it.
It's amazing that those elements, you know, actor's performance, sound, art design in that limited budget can give you little character details. Like, how powerful storytelling doesn't need a lot of bells and whistles to convey and really give the audience a sense of who these characters are and paint the world. Like, something like her voice paints the picture of the world she comes from for you.
Sure.
Like, it's really powerful and good. Yeah, you don't need exploding robots. Michael Bay.
Yeah, I didn't. I'm not going to name names, but yeah.
Also, I just want to say this anime passes the Bechdel test, like, whoa. You have, you know, are you familiar with the Bechdel test?
Yeah, this is, you can explain it, but it's
well, it's named after Alison Bechdel, who is this amazing cartoonist. She wrote Dykes to Watch Out For, but what really propelled her into fame was her memoirs that she wrote about each of her parents. But she, this test was coined after one of the strips she had written in Dykes to Watch Out For, where a couple characters were talking about what does it take for a movie to, you know, pass a test, essentially. And that's, are there more than one female character?
Right.
One. Two, do they talk to each other?
Right.
And three, if they do interact and talk to each other, do they talk to each other about something that's not a man?
Right.
And so you have these two main female characters that are talking to each other and discussing, like, the ethics of the issues and the morals that they're facing and coming to blows with each other. you know, it's really great. And it caught me off guard. I wasn't expecting that. And, two strong female leads.
Right. And if I could briefly throw it back, I mean, Utena also passes the, the Bechdel test. Although they do talk about guys a lot.
Well, they do. That whole show is about relationships.
Right. But yeah, I think... Obviously, as a kid, when I was growing up, there weren't a lot of strong female roles.
In that time period, late 80s,
In the 80s? No, man. It was all the super powerful guy saves the girl and she loves him forever. And that was kind of the deal. I think one of the things that Miu really, really affected in me was that here is a girl who on the surface is, you know, powerless and small and tiny. And yet she basically runs the show. You're intrigued by her, and of course, her whole relationship with Himiko. What is their relationship? And because what ends up happening is Himiko kind of becomes obsessed with Miu.
Mm-hmm. Like, starts seeing her everywhere.
Yeah, well, everywhere is every couple of months, but she's always looking for her. Like, once she finds out that she exists, that Shinma are real and stuff, it changes her worldview. And then she starts taking jobs because she thinks Miu might show up. So some guy comes and he's like, oh, you know, I think there's a ghost over here. And she's like, whatever. And then this guy's like, oh, yeah, I think my daughter turned into a doll. And she's like, Miu might be there. I'm going to go check that out.
So. But a lot of it is like, I got to go there because I want to stop Miu from doing whatever she's about to do.
Yeah.
Because it's, again, their fundamental disagreement on human lives.
Yeah, and this is awesome to me, and I'm glad you brought that up. In the first episode, it establishes their antagonistic relationship because, spoiler, the girl who's asleep has been possessed by Shinma. And the Shinma is basically making her dreams a reality, but in return, stealing her life, which is why she's kind of dreaming about this vampire, because she views herself as a vampire for reasons that you should watch the show. But anyway, when Miu rids her of the Shinma possession, she'll die.
Mm-hmm.
And so Miu's answer to this is, I can give her eternal life. I'll turn her into a vampire. But Himiko sees that she's about to bite the girl and runs in and is like, no, and grabs her from Miu and, quote, saves her, quote. And I think one of my absolute favorite moral quandaries at the end is after, in a very visually spectacular and stylistically awesome fashion, Miu has sealed the Shinma away, the offending Shinma rotten. And then the girl, Himiko, is like, well, what about this girl? She's going to die. And Miu is like, yeah, well, I could have prevented that, but you interfered.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know. Eat it.
Is it better to let the person die or to give them, let them live, but with they're now a vampire and living
right.
this
immortal, and that, yeah.
a shell of themselves, perhaps?
Perhaps. That comes into four later. But that's another deep issue. But this is the first time that the dual side of an ideal situation had ever been presented to me. So earlier in the show, the guy who lost his girlfriend, he's like consumed by grief. Miu, who always likes beautiful victims, sees him as he's in the park trying to hunt the vampire. And she goes and she's like, I can give you eternal life in a dream world. You'll be happy. And this kind of happens off camera. But the guy is like, yeah, anything to get rid of this grief. Because he's so consumed with grief that his girlfriend, who was the first victim. So she does. She feeds off him and gives him eternal life. And he goes into this kind of trance-like stupor where... he just sits on a swing all day, but he doesn't age anymore. But he's eternally happy.
Mm.
And so Himiko sees this and is like, you're a monster. That is horrendous and I can't believe it. And the Miu is like, all right, A, I have to live. I need to drink blood just as much as you need to eat or breathe.
Mm-hmm.
And B, he was so consumed with grief that he asked me and now he's eternally happy. Who's right? Drop the mic. Like...
gosh,
that blew my mind. I was like, who is right? Who doesn't want to live forever? And that's kind of a recurring theme.
Is it better
to be
a slave but always happy, or is it better to be aware and suffering your entire life?
Exactly. It's a tough one, man, and it's something that I really identified with as a teenager.
And it's also the whole, you know, what justifies the evil, you know, the evil of, you know, evil quote unquote of drinking someone's blood to live so then you can go on and fight and kill things that are going to hurt more people.
Exactly.
Like, you know, what...
it's tough, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was a fascinating experiment to me. That relationship, that kind of antagonistic relationship is what drives the entire series, where Himiko is essentially, like you said, trying to stop Miu, and Miu is trying to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was really... fascinating. And that's just the first episode. So that is, you know, it drew me in with its looks, with its sounds. The plot is fantastic. The questions it raises are very interesting and dynamic. Did you have any aspects of episode one that you wanted to touch on?
Is it wrong that when I started watching it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like Dexter, where have you seen any of Dexter?
I have. So I did not make that connection.
In the sense that you're born of blood. So I think it was the girl, not getting too deep into what happened to her, but seeing what happened to her parents.
Right.
That sure. affected her and kind of created a bloodlust in her.
Yeah. Well, because she received the transfusion.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Gotcha. And so just that element of it reminded me a bit of if you enjoy the show Dexter seasons 1 through 4, because I refuse to acknowledge the last 4 seasons.
Fair enough.
This would be a definite score for you to watch. So I just noticed that kind of element of blood and liquid. And I think that keeps coming into the theme. I was just also so intrigued by, you know, they started to paint this world of the Shinma who are god and demon. And I was wondering, I don't know a lot about Japanese mythology in that regard, as far as religion and paranormal aspects. But can you speak to that, Mason? Anything about, like, what are the origins of these monsters? And, like, what religious traditions are they rooted in? Is it Shinto and Buddhism?
Or, like, yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I also am not an expert, let me clarify that. But I think it's coming from Shinto, Buddhism, or actually primarily folklore, probably, like Japanese folklore. Because after she identifies the Shinma in the first episode, and she's like, it's rotten. And then Himiko is like, rotten? What? And then she's like, and Miyu is like, oh, more commonly known as Baku, I think. And she's like, a Shinma that dwells in your dreams. Which I've always taken to be that it's some myth that's founded in either Buddhism or Shinto or like Japanese folklore, you know. And I think most of the Shinma are concepts that are taken from that in the OVA. Let me be clear.
Yeah.
Because in the TV series, it goes, in my mind, off track. And we'll probably talk about the TV series in a different episode, because I will begrudgingly say that it's maybe worth your time to watch. I know other people will disagree with me, but anyway. But the OVA is definitely on there. So yeah, that's my main thing. I guess that's pretty much it for episode one. I highly recommend it. The music is amazing. But we'll talk about that more in the next aspect.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to say my initial reaction too, and I think that this is, aside from the ethical conflict, tradition versus modernity. That to me is what Japan is all about, because you have a society that's deeply, deeply rooted in its traditional culture, but then has this hyper neo forward progressive culture that it also celebrates. So seeing where those two meet, you know, to me is something that I think, you know, the creators were asking, especially back in the 80s, because you had that time of economic flourish.
Yeah, economic booming.
Exactly. And so, you know, again, this story, tradition versus modernity, the fact that it's set in these historical places in Kyoto, and it's dealing with a lot of traditional themes, but you have...
That's really fascinating, because you're right, because Miyu, when she shows up, and one of the things I do want to talk about at some point is her outfits. Her outfits change in each episode, but she's always very classical and very formally dressed in kimonos and stuff, and she's always interacting with Himiko, who is running around in very modern, you know, she wears pants, she wears business suits and whatever, and very sophisticated looking on a modern standpoint. And it's also interesting that you talk about that, because yes, Himiko arrives in the modern convenience, she flies in on the airplane, she's at the airport or wherever, and then as she goes over into meeting Miyu, it's like in these parks by these temples.
A regression kind of back into history, almost.
That's
a really good point.
Which you'll tie in on episode 4, because they're going back to the original capital or whatever, which I'll be interested in hearing about.
And really quickly, before we move on to episode 2, I have the origin of lemon, in case you're wondering.
I would love it.
So lemon, the term originated from an early hentai series named Cream Lemon, 1984. Kurimu Lemon. And so that lemon, that's where lemon, the term came from.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. The more you know.
Thank you. Thank you, Sarah. Episode one is phenomenal. I have a rule in my watching of anime that if the first episode rocks, usually the rest of the series sucks. And if the first episode kind of sucks, the rest of the series is usually awesome. Miyu totally blows that away. It's all awesome. Each episode just got better. So, well, that's not entirely true, but each episode was amazing in its own way. So anyway, let's move on to episode number 2, which is by far one of my favorite, mostly because the villain is just amazing.
Yeah, these are all kind of Monster of the Week episodes as well, I should mention.
That's true.
So it's an easy story to watch and to pick up. Yeah, I recommend you start from the beginning, but yeah. Like it's easy to very watchable.
Like Zara said, the format is very Monster of the Week, but the through line of Miyu's backstory and kind of her whole mission and everything and her relationship with Himiko is what keeps you coming back. And it's a very well executed rendition of all that. Anyway, so now we're going to go into episode 2. So this is fall, which is my favorite season in general. And it all kind of revolves around school. And it's the first time that you see Miyu as a schoolgirl. She apparently, when she's not off moonlighting as a
vampire
monster
hunter.
Yeah, vampire princess.
Princess, vampire princess, Shima Hunter.
She enrolls at school, different schools around under assumed names or whatever. And she runs around in this uniform and kind of keeps tabs on things, which is interesting. But at this particular school is one guy whose name is K. He goes by K. And this guy is K-E-I. And this guy is hands down the most attractive man, apparently, that has ever...
in the world.
Yeah, because... every girl who sees him, Miyu and the Shinma and even Himiko, if they see him, they're just like, oh my God, wow, he's really hot. Like, I really want to interact with this guy. And then what ends up happening is at the school is a girl who is turned into a doll. People don't realize it, but a girl disappears. And later a doll is found, a really creepy kind of mannequin doll.
Yeah, the episode opens with the shot of a bunch of kind of broken down mannequins. And
yeah, marionettes.
Marionettes, yeah. So, after we summarize it, puppetry and kind of Japanese theater, this episode is laden with Japanese theatrical
imagery. Yeah, I'm going to let you go off. I'm going to be fascinated by everything you say. The mannequins, the marionettes, all that stuff, it's in there. But anyway, and also this concept of the doll that they bring up where the doll is ageless. The doll is eternal. It doesn't age. It doesn't grow old. And Miyu, like, relates to the doll in that respect, which I thought was kind of interesting. And this entire episode is about not wanting to grow old.
Mm-hmm. Eternal life.
Yeah, / grow up, ? Because that's the whole
eternal youth
aspect. Or is it? Or was it just love? Also, this is a love story, which I dig love stories and I dig romance. Anyway, they're at the school and this girl disappears. She becomes a doll and her father wants to figure out what happens. He hires Himiko to come and investigate it because he's like, I'm pretty sure this doll is my daughter. Someone found this sketch of a doll. And so Himiko's like, oh, all right, I'll go check it out. But secretly she's like, oh, I think this sounds like something Miu would be involved in. So I'm going to go check it out.
She's obsessed
with finding answers and also stopping quote unquote Miu. So anyway, so she goes to the school and it's true. Miu's there. And Himiko runs into Kay and she's like, wow, this Kay guy is really hot. And it turns out Kay is a mortal guy and he has a girlfriend, but he meets this Shinma, who is Shinma Ranka, who I have to say is voiced by Mayumi Shu amazingly. Right on par with Miyu and Himiko. Like, the female voice talent in this show is through the roof in my mind. In the Japanese version, let me be clear. So anyway, he meets this Shinma, who is masquerading as a schoolgirl. And the Shinma is very taken with Kay and his good looks. And so he's very taken with her in her human form. And they start hanging out together. And Miyu sees this and she's like, all right, I have to hunt the Shinma. And also she's trying to take Kay from me and I want Kay. So I'm going to go do this. And then there's this whole thing where Kay is hanging with the Shinma because he says the Shinma can make him immortal. Like, he doesn't want to, he's like, I'm so beautiful. I don't want to age and grow old. And the Shinma is like, there is a way that I can make you not grow old anymore, which is turning him into a doll. But she's like, it's not, I don't want to do it.
And part of that's from this, he has this conflicted family background, right? Like, isn't his brother putting pressure on him?
It's his parents are putting pressure on him. Like,
And a party bus just drove by. Yeah.
Film recorded live in West Hollywood. Yeah, no, his parents His mother and his father are, you got to do better, Kay. Why don't you be more like your older brother?
That's
like,
right.
He's so good.
And his older brother's like, you got to join dad's company. Like, yeah,
well, his older brother is, his older brother is basically like, don't worry about it. We all know we're going to go work for dad, but you need to at least try.
Yeah.
And then, so Kay is just like, he just doesn't relate. He doesn't really connect with
people. His desire for eternal youth, is that like an escape from that family situation?
I think that's part of it, right? I mean, if you could go off and, I know as a teenager, I was like, man, if I could go off and run off with my girlfriend and not have to deal with my parents, that'd be great. I think that's definitely part of it. But also, I think it's just true love, man. Like, he fell pretty hard for the Shinra.
Ranka.
Yeah, exactly. And Ranka fell pretty hard for him. And Miyu, it's interesting to say, does Miyu actually want to be with Kay? Or is she just interested because she wants some blood from a beautiful person? Or is it a power play between them?
Yeah, I got the impression that she was more upset that she lost more than anything. That she didn't succeed in her objective.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that this episode does stick with me is because Miyu loses, essentially. In most anime, it's kind of like, oh, here's some trials, and you overcome it, you win, and you move forward. But in this one, you know, she kind of lost. She tried to get the guy to let her feed from him, and he was like, no, I'd rather go be with Shima. So big surprise at the end.
To let her feed.
Yeah, well, it's true. So big surprise. Miyu does face off against Shinra Ranka, but her whole deal is, I want you to back off from Kay because I want him. And Ranka is like, I'm not going to back off. So you're going to either have to fight me or whatever. And Miyu is like, I'm going to let you slide right now, but I'm going to come back, because Miyu goes to make a play for Kay. Yeah. And when Miyu actually confronts Kay about it, she offers him eternal, you know, life. And he actually says to her that it's not about preserving his looks. It's about that he's in love with this girl. And Miyu is like, you don't even understand. She's a monster. Mm. But what's interesting is Miyu's the same thing.
Right.
Like, she's
a different brand of monster.
Yeah. What really rocks it to me in this one is Ranka is actually in love with Kay. And so she doesn't want to turn him into a doll. And so the compromise on this is that she turns him into another Shinma like her. Like, she reveals her Shinma form, which is this kind of really, really cool looking...
Looks like a doll.
Yeah, like but a skeleton doll kind of thing. And, you know, she's like, can you love him like this, Miyu? Because I can. And Miyu's like, oh, man. No, I'm not into him. He doesn't look human anymore. And she's like, yeah, you know, you're shallow. I love him like this. And now we're going to talk about the theater aspect of it.
Yeah. So this episode is laden in Japanese traditional theater imagery, specifically no. First of all, the movements of Ranka. Well, okay. So a lot of Japanese theatrical traditions kind of grew off of each other. So we start with gagaku, which were court dances that kind of had a religious underpinning to them.
And is this like from... Genji era?
This is okay. 600.
Oh, okay.
400 to 600 AD, I believe. And then coming from that tradition, you have no, which is a little bit later. I think we're talking about like 1,000. Mm-hmm. And from no, you have kyogen, which is the humor, the kind of comedic relief that they play in between no plays. And then from no, you also have influences in traditional Japanese dance, Nihon Buyo. Also, Bunraku, Japanese puppet theater, kind of came about around the same time, again, kind of influenced by the traditions of no. And so when the episode opens and I see all these marionettes, I'm thinking, okay, there's going to be a lot of like Bunraku symbolism. But it's interesting. They're playing with the idea of theatricality in general. So it's at one point you see Ranka, the demon, the Shinma's feet moving, and she's doing suriyashi, which is like a slipping of the feet.
That's something that I noticed, not to cut you off. That's something that I noticed in a lot of this OVAs is they look at the feet and how they're stepping.
Yes.
And Miyu, for example, is always barefoot. When she's a schoolgirl, she has shoes. But if she's ever like in her hunter mode, she's always barefoot. And around one foot is a red ribbon, which I'm not sure what the deal with that is. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. It's kind of like her calling card. You see that foot step forward with the red ribbon and you're like, oh, Miyu time.
Yeah, yeah. And the musical cue.
But like suriyashi is a form of inno, and in Nihonbuyo, it's creating a sense of floating. So it's often used cool. for spirit characters. And no is laden with, you know, characters who are spirits, angry spirits, grieving spirits. And so I believe they focus on the feet of Ranka doing this movement to just underpin that idea that she's otherworldly. She's a spirit. She is not of this earth. Another thing they do is they have the clapboard sound and then, you know, the traditional yo, which you hear a lot in no and also a little bit in kabuki. They open the episode with it. They close it out with it. It's a really lush soundscape, just incorporating all these Japanese theatrical traditions. And you wonder, again, why throw all of this for this character, this episode? What does it mean that she's a theatrical character?
Yeah, I do wonder that, because when she turns Kay into the monster, mm-hmm. it's through this type of dance that you were explaining. I thought it was no theater, but it's not. It's something else.
No, Nihonbuyo came from no. Oh, it is. Like, okay. So that's what I'm saying. The traditions are very linked. The further back in time you go.
Yeah. They do this ritual with the, and in the background, one of my favorite musical pieces is the koto and the
shamisen.
The shamisen and the clapboard. And it's almost like a wedding.
Ah, highlighting the love story.
Yeah, well, you got the cherry blossoms kind of floating.
That's the next thing I was going to talk about.
Go ahead.
So, like, you see petals, especially at the end of the episode, it closes out on petals falling on Ranka and Kei, right? Mm-hmm.
As they walk off into...
The petals falling, sakura petals specifically, is a symbol of springtime. So it's interesting that it's set in fall, but you have this, you know, spring petal imagery. So sakura only blooms in April, usually, is the blooming season in Japan. And the thing about sakura, the reason why it's such a celebrated tree and flower in Japan is because it's ephemeral. The blossoms are beautiful. They don't bloom for very long. And once they leave, it symbolizes life is beautiful, whether you're at the start, like the dormant tree, the tree that's budding, the full flower. And when the flower falls away, its ephemerality, is that a word?
Sure.
is what makes it beautiful. And so it's ironic, I think, a little bit that it's used for these two people who are living forever now, who are kind of immortal.
But they're leaving the earthly realm.
So maybe it's their time. It's life is ephemeral because the sakura petals represent the changing nature of life.
That's very interesting.
And they're a classical symbol of romance because romance is temporary.
Right.
Right.
Eternal love.
It doesn't exist.
But also Miyu, who is in a very interesting kimono in this episode when she's in her vampire mode. It's a red kimono, which in my research, I found out that if you're wearing a white kimono, it means you're dead, or it's for the dead people. Or maybe that's a black kimono. Well, no. White's for dead, right? And black
white,
is for wedding?
But I think white is a symbol of...
Dead?
Of dead. Actually, like white and black stripes. I don't know about just black.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, anyway. But I found out a red kimono can also be the symbol of a prisoner.
Oh.
Which I was just kind of like, all right.
Hey. And Miyu's wearing a red kimono.
Miyu is wearing a red kimono, but also, and it's got this, the oboe sash. Obi sash, mm-hmm. Yeah. And Ranka uses as a weapon, which I thought was pretty cool. But also, and I was really interested in this, Miyu has this like veil that she hangs out under, and she uses it as some sort of weapon. Like she'll throw it at the Shinma, and if it falls on them, I guess something happens.
But
Ranka always avoids it or whatever. So at the end of the episode, after all of this, what she's essentially doing is distracting Miyu while Kei completes the transformation. And then they do this no dance, or this dance where they go through each other and essentially become one type thing.
Yeah, they do.
looking in your direction.
Well, they do a dance. They do a little dance. They make a little love. They basically get down tonight.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's very, you know, again, from the movements of Nihonbuyo, traditional Japanese dance. And one thing I was trying to think about is...
Is that a wedding dance?
That's a good question.
Oh, okay.
Well, see, here's the thing. I was trying to think about what, if any, no story archetypes this particular thing falls into. Like what you said earlier, like each episode's a morality play. Mm-hmm. No is sort of similar in that you have these different spirits often in no examining, you know, okay, they're tied to a place, for instance. Why are they tied to that place? Like what happened that, how were they wronged? Who wronged them? Mm-hmm. Are they getting revenge? And like a woman's revenge is a big theme in No, like an angry female spirit.
Sure. She gets her own mask, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. She's a distinct character. So thinking about the idea of this, you know, of dueling female spirits is what you essentially have here with Miyu and Ranka. There's also stories about lovers double suicide.
Shinju. Which is in episode 3. But we'll get to that in a minute.
Mm. And I think there's like echoes of it here with the two lovers kind of cementing their eternal love for each other.
Oh,
in a sense, heading away from life.
Good point.
Yeah.
Man, Zara.
Deep moments.
On point. Good job.
Deep moments with Zara.
Yeah. I like it. I agree with you. And I definitely got the impression from their dance or whatever that it was kind of a marriage.
Mm.
And that they were walking off essentially down the aisle into their new life together.
Mm.
Very interesting to call into question, what is everyone's motivations here? Obviously, Kay, who is a guy instead of a girl, as is typically the case, is the object of desire, the object of beauty. You know, his character is borderline non-existent. But he's basically the trophy that everybody wants. And what is everyone's motivations for it? Miyu's is, I think, lust, and Ranka's love, and Himiko, I don't know.
Well, Himiko,
old woman charm.
It's interesting because Himiko goes to investigate, but it's out of kind of concern. She doesn't want another human life lost to either of these people.
Sure. I mean, I think that's the general view. But then, I guess you're right. I guess it doesn't really affect her. Miyu often argues with her on that point. The crux of the episode for me is Himiko is once again verbally sparring with Miyu at the end, and she's like, I'm sorry that you lost this time, Miyu. And Miyu is like, no, I beat the Shinma. I sent it to the dark. I did my job. And Himiko says, I don't mean as the hunter. I mean as the woman. And I got to tell you, as an adolescent boy watching that, I was just like, me and my friend were just like, oh my God, like, did that just happen?
That's so funny.
Yeah, because I got to tell you, it's, you know, it was unheard of to hear a fairly attractive female protagonist not
getting what she set out to get from a man.
You know, because if it was a shonen manga, a guy manga, you know, the guy usually quests after the girl, and it's flipping that was very eye-opening for me.
Yeah.
As a young boy.
That's a really good point. For me, watching that, you know, just having seen the show, not at the age I am now, I thought it was a moment of the women bonding on something and understanding each other about something where before it had just been friction. Like, I don't agree with your ways, from Himiko to Miyu, and Miyu being like, this is the way it is and deal with it. And then this is the moment where Himiko is like, hey, I see you. I see the human part of you.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an excellent point. I do think that this is the point that actually kind of draws them together a little bit. Like, they can relate to each other on that point. That's excellent. I hadn't realized that. No, it's an excellent point. Verbal sparring also between Shinma, Ranka, and Miyu is really great. I'm not giving it enough justice, but the dialogue in this episode is fantastic. And of course, the art direction and sound design is equally awesome. And I don't know, any final thoughts on episode 2?
No. It was creepy, y'all. Oh my God, when the blood is coming off of the dead marionette's eyes.
Oh, yeah.
There's just so much cool imagery in it. Like, I'm really psyched that I opened my October watching this.
Yeah, right.
Like, it's a great way to get ready for all the ghoulishness of this month.
It is, in essence, a horror anime, and it just handles everything really, really spectacularly. And the art is amazing. And yeah, the marionettes just look creepy. Like, Shinra Ranka turns her victims into these creepy, cool marionettes. And at one point, Miyu is attacking Shinra Ranka, but one of her marionettes jumps up. Well, I don't know if she causes it to rise or it jumps up of its own free will to block her and save the Shinma. But in essence, Larva kills it by accident, and then that's it.
Speaking of Larva.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about Larva.
Episode 3 is...
Yeah, that's...
Larva-centric.
Yeah, it is. And so... Episode 3, which takes place in winter, which is pretty awesome. Watching snowfall in Kyoto is always an amazing experience. Larva is Miyu's like silent companion, and you don't really know much about him. He wears this mask, which is itself theatrical.
Yes. So the mask is actually from Venetian carnival. It's a Venetian carnival mask from Italy. Called Volto, or I believe it's also called Larva. So it's very much a throwback to Italy, which is interesting because thinking about just vampires in general, a lot of vampire mythology, lots of different cultures have it. But I feel like, you know, Italy, France, these places in Europe, you really strongly link to vampirism.
Yeah, Carpathia, all that stuff. I agree. And it's fascinating to hear that the mask, I thought the mask was original. I did not know that it had any sort of roots, but it does look kind of like a masquerade mask. Mm-hmm. It's a really interesting mask. Like, you should definitely check it out. It's
very simple, but effective. And ominous looking.
Ominous. Larva, after he was bonded to Miyu, his voice was sealed away and he has to wear this mask. So he can't talk.
And you don't have to animate his facial expression.
Yeah, and you don't have to hire a voice actor. Although they do later, very briefly. And Larva becomes this kind of protector of Miyu. He's kind of her bodyguard. Like, anytime a situation gets, if she gets over her head or whatever, she'll ask him for help. And I think one of the things that I do really like about this show is their relationship. I think their relationship is fascinating because even though he barely speaks, it's very clear that he cares so deeply for her. They talk a little bit about it in this episode. Miyu does have feelings for him, although I think at this point they're kind of unclear. He's kind of a father figure, older brother, but also he's really hot. If you've seen him without the mask, he's really hot.
Larva's dreamy.
Right.
That's all there really is to it. He's just Dream City. And I think that this archetype, again, of the idea of a guardian figure that's neither, you know, it's neither a father and it's neither a lover. It's somewhere in between.
Yeah, I definitely think that part of the appeal of it all, and this is something that I talked about in C-47. See, I did a sci-fi show with Zara.
That I starred in.
Yeah, exactly. Called C-47, which is really amazing. Check it out if you can ever find it. There are men who are strong and will protect you and will lay down their life for you and will do whatever, but are not interested in you sexually.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, that just doesn't come into the equation just yet. It's always kind of simmering behind closed doors.
And like Larva, Lena and Gowri. Slayers.
Oh yeah, exactly.
Which
I
don't like that happened. Sorry.
Oh,
go ahead.
We'll
get there someday. Slayers.
Yeah, well, someday. But Larva and Miyu kind of exemplify that. So there very clearly is some sort of bond between them that's very deep that somebody can't just step into, and it's very clear that Larva is like super hot, but it's not sexual? Question mark.
The ambiguity of relationships is something that Japanese media does really well.
That's true.
It's like leaving the relationship open, and so you're constantly wondering, when are they gonna, are they ever gonna,
like, what is the deal, what is going on? Because Larva will assist Miyu in hunting victims, and she only hunts victims that she finds attractive in some way, so he'll help her in that respect. And he also helps her hunt and banish Shinma, which is interesting because he is himself a Shinma and so has been turned against his own kind. So that's kind of interesting. In the manga, they have a very explicit relationship.
Really?
Yeah. In the manga, it's a little different. The manga came out after the OVA.
Which you mentioned was kind of rare.
Very rare.
For an OVA to come out first, then a manga based on it.
Yeah, very rare.
Then an animated series.
Yeah, and like I said, I think... I mean, if I can put on my, I don't know.
Spectacles?
No, if I can put on my guess hat. I can't remember the word that I'm looking for.
Thinking cap?
No.
Guess hat. Go with that.
Yeah, guess hat. I think that this was a passion project. This was a passion, but like the husband and wife were like, I want to do a project that's kind of get us known. Like, we've been doing some Lemon stuff and some lesser known stuff. Like, let's do some of our own stuff. We've got, you know, the skills and the people. And this was a passion project. So they, you know, they did the OVA and it became, not super popular, but it definitely established a cult following, like a serious cult following. People were like, Miyu is awesome. The character designs are awesome. And that in turn caused them to be like, all right, well, let's do a manga.
Mm.
And then after that, they got the TV series. But in the manga, to briefly digress, Larva speaks. He's not sealed behind the mask. Surprise. And they have a...
We have the budget to animate yeah. you now.
or draw you in a panel. But yeah. Well, in the TV series, yeah, he does speak and he has a voice actor and everything. But in the manga, they have a pretty explicit romantic relationship. They openly confess love for each other. Mm. They're like, I love you. I cannot think of life without you. And they... You know, do the thing where they hover inches away from each other and almost kiss or whatever.
That's sweet.
Yeah. Or full of tension. But yeah, and they touch on that in this episode. So in this episode, in episode 3, it's winter and Himiko is contacted directly by Miyu for the first time ever. Himiko's, mm-hmm. I think she's just sitting in Kyoto, like smoking a cigarette in a park.
She's so badass.
Yeah, she's like contemplating.
Her 80s hair.
Yeah. Outfits. But she rocks it.
She does. I want that haircut. Sorry.
You could get that haircut.
Just bring a picture to my salon.
Do it. But yeah, she's just kind of sitting there like having coffee or whatever and like watching the snow. And then Miyu comes to her and is like, yo, I need your help.
Mm.
So that's kind of crazy. Miyu obviously almost never asks for help. Mm-hmm. And B, like, why Himiko?
Mm-hmm.
And kudos to the writers for this setup. So Larva has been kidnapped and locked away or isolated, imprisoned in a wall, in a really cool visual of just his mask on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. So simple, so effective.
Yeah, so good.
Just the idea of, I mean, it, for me, seeing the mask on the wall evoked all these ideas of, you know, it's just his shell.
Yes.
That's there. And whatever essence that makes him is gone. And it's just his shell on display.
Yeah. Yeah. And everything else is locked, frozen within, you know, like he can't get out and stuff. And it's great. It's wonderful art direction.
Again, when you constrain people, when you constrain creators and give them limitations based on budget, they will find really creative and cool, subtle ways to tell powerful points.
That is true. There is a very powerful theory called excellence through adversity. And that you reach artistic excellence through the struggle, through the adversity.
Writing this down.
and everyone's number one example of this is the original Star Wars trilogy. That, you know, George Lucas went out there, everything went wrong. People were fainting in the desert. Like, you know, the droid costumes were breaking down all the time and, you know, all the stuff. But he just was like, let's do it. Like, we're just going to do it. We're just going to make it happen. And excellence has been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And I argue that this is on this similar wavelength, that excellence through adversity. It was a struggle. It was budget restrictions and stuff. And yet, you know, they really pulled it off very powerful because you scathe away all the bells and whistles and get to the
really
core
matters.
Of like,
concentrate it.
Yeah. Mm, so good. Distill it.
Yeah.
You know? And it's good times. So anyway, Miyu comes and asks Himiko for help because Larva's been imprisoned. And Himiko, because she's a spiritualist, can actually help. She inscribes the wall with spiritual barriers to keep other demons away from him. And then I guess the main crux is there is a Shinma who that basically looks like an enchanted suit of samurai armor.
Yes.
That is running around town doing stuff. And he runs into Miyu and he's like, fight me. And she's like, I can't fight you. So for whatever reason, she can't fight this Shinma. So she goes and gets Himiko and she's like, you have to fight him. And in a pretty hilarious scene, the armor comes after Himiko and Himiko uses a Buddhist chant.
Can we talk about this?
Yeah, we'll talk about it. I just want to get the original. So in the Japanese version, Himiko uses a Buddhist chant as a defense. And she's got these really cool rings. It's two rings kind of above the knuckles of her left hand.
Mm.
And when she twiddles her fingers, they chime together. They'll do this like chime, 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 chime thing. And so she starts doing the Buddhist chant and chiming. And for whatever reason, the Shinma suit of armor is like, oh, I can't handle it. And he disappears. And the revelation of it is discussed later in the episode about why this works and why Miyu can't fight him and stuff. But we're going to digress here for just one second. So This we're going to have a huge debate about this at some point in the future. But there is the eternal question of sub versus dub, which is subtitled, listening to the original Japanese audio and reading the subtitles versus dubbing it into your native language, in this case, in my case, English. And so the English dub versus the sub. And so it's sub versus dub. And okay, I am pretty squarely in the sub category. I like the original voice acting. I find it usually suits the tone better. It usually suits the characters better because the lip movement is actually drawn to the native speaking. Not that it matters too much in animation, but it does matter a little bit. But I also find that Japanese voice actors for anime are just usually better. Like, they have a better connection to the character and their delivery is just better, because what ends up happening is Americans buy the property, bring it over here, haven't watched it really at all, don't really get the characters at all, and just they're like, that's a guy, hire a guy, that's a girl, hire a girl. And you know, and these American actors obviously aren't going to take the time to watch the project, or I don't even know if that's even actually you could probably tell me.
Yeah, is
that even
I was gonna say, so here's the thing. As a voice actor, mm-hmm. who works on things, I haven't done a lot of dubbed anime, but I've worked on projects like that. I am not going to poo-poo the work of other voice actors, because there are some fantastic dubs out there. There are some fantastic actors out there who are doing dubs. However, when this was dubbed in the late 80s, this industry was just growing. So yes, at that time, they were like, yeah, let's get a guy. Let's get a person. And that person did the best they could, knowing as little as they did of the material, and basically like focused on matching rather than the performance.
Right.
However,
I just want to defend myself real quick.
Yes.
I agree with you. Voice acting and dubs are very difficult thing to do. I admire the actors that do it, and they do. There are good dubs. I have seen good dubs. They do exist. The Princess Mononoke dub in particular, amazing. You know, and there's lots of anime out there that does have good dubs. I just feel that in this one,
this is not a good dub. Like, I'm sorry.
Okay.
So Mason, I am totally with you.
Okay.
As a speaker of Japanese, like, I studied it for 4 years in college.
And, oh, wow.
You know, like, I love the original. There's all these nuances in there, and I just love hearing the Japanese language.
Mm-hmm.
However, if a dub is done well, it can be really cool. Translation, you know, my favorite quote, I think it was Brian Friel, translator equals traitor. And I love that, because it's no matter how hard you work as a translator to stay original to the piece, you're gonna end up fudging it somewhere, in the sense that, because there's not always a literal translation. And so you do the best you can. But what a good translation would do in any language is to take the source material, be inspired by it, and then through the translation and the, you know, subsequent rendering of it through acting, transform it into something that's in the tone and spirit that the original piece intended, even if it's not precisely the same. That's what a good dub does.
Yes.
This is not
crux.
A good dub.
Yeah.
It doesn't match the tone. The sounds, first of all, like, they're speaking all over the place. Like, they're in an intimate room together, and you have one voice actor who's kind of speaking at this level, and then you have another voice actor coming in high here. It's like they don't know that they're in the space that they're played. And, you know, again, it's a hard job. I'm not crapping on these actors that were hired for this particular dub. I'm not crapping on the director, but it's a collective effort where you really have to work to match the tone and not make it forced in any way, especially in a piece like this where you have these otherworldly elements, and it's easy to go campy with it.
Yeah, it's easy
to go campy.
Right.
But for instance, the reason we bring it up, and I hope maybe Mason, you'd be able to play a sound bite.
I'll put the sample in so people can hear it.
There's Himiko, who's awesome, is saying a curse. And the curse in English is just so, I can't even describe. You just have to listen to it.
I mean, I flat out think that, like I said, in the Japanese, it is a Buddhist chant. And I think either the director didn't have time to try and figure it out, or the actress was just like,
she couldn't make it sound cool. It just sounds
because
like
there, I mean, what she says is just gibberish. There's just nothing, you know, I mean, they were like, make a bunch of sounds, kind of, or whatever.
And she does it at one kind of pitch all the way through, and she over enunciates it. So it just sounds like, have you ever heard like a person with a strong American accent attempt Japanese, and like every syllable is like dozo hajime mashite zera des dozo yoroshiku, like that's it's so like accurate. there's no attempt to make it sound foreign and otherworldly. I mean, you're invoking a curse, for God's sake. Use your imagination, at least sound cool.
It's
so bad. And then like all the people who listen to that and they're like, yeah, this is good, let's push it forward, yeah. Like that to me is just, and I know it was the 80s, I know times were different,
but no, this is what gets me, is because the 80s had we're getting off topic, but the 80s had such good dubs. Voltron, Robotech, like all the anime back in the 80s was amazing. Akira, like the original Akira.
You know what? It's clear that the creators of the English dub maybe didn't have the budget.
I mean, okay, but like I often wonder, like Thundercats, like all the voice acting in the 80s cartoons, all the voice acting's through the roof. And I just wonder, like, what happened?
Well, I mean, those are probably projects that had more money to focus on the dub because they were being released for a wider audience.
Well, I just mean, I think the voice acting was better, like Larry King.
Because they had the money to pay for good actors. Something like this, where it's like, okay, let's dub it and just get it out fast. They probably didn't have the same budget and didn't have the same access to the same talent pool.
But the actors who dubbed this went on to greatness.
Did they?
I think. I don't know.
We're not poo-pooing specific actors. But I do have an opinion.
You want me to name names?
We're not going to name names, but I just, okay. This dub is so bad.
Yeah, the dub is really...
In comparison to how good the Japanese acting is.
Yeah, like I said, I think for me, and like Zara said, it comes down with tone and what are you going to do with that? And they threw the tone out the window. Miyu sounds like a valley girl who doesn't care about anything. And Himiko is kind of playing it like a comic book character.
I'm sorry, Himiko, but you're on your own.
You can't be serious.
They're not taking it seriously. Like, whatever's going on.
So it becomes cheesy as opposed to creepy.
Right. And which destroys the experience for me. I'll show you some examples. Anyway.
Back to episode three.
That's a debate that we plan to have, because I wonder if you can really ever match the original... voice acting of a project. You know, if it's originally in English, can anyone dub it and make it sound cool?
Can a dub ever surpass the original?
Good question.
Yeah.
Good question. We should definitely talk about that. All right. So the point is, Himiko shows up and she chants, and the big twist is the armor is not a Shinma. It is a human spirit who...
Oh, he saw his wife and then
he got killed. He got terminally ill. He was terminally ill or whatever. And... his wife was like, no, anything so that you can live. And she cut a deal with a Shinma named Lemuris, who is a, quote, good friend, quote, of Larva, who actually shows back up in the manga when they come to get Larva back. His little brother shows up or something, because Lemuris doesn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
But Lemuris, for some reason, is like obsessed with Larva. He's like way into Larva.
And who wouldn't be?
Well, yeah.
Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Larva.
He's a beautiful creature. He's not human. Keep that in mind.
That's a bonus.
I was totally down with
Larva.
I was totally down with Larva. I was like, your head is amazing. But then you see his hand and it's like this weird skeleton vein thing.
Like red fingernails?
Red fingernails, white skin, like white skin, and then black knuckles.
He got too much sun.
That's kind of bizarre. Anyway, but Lemuris is like, oh, Larva, I need to save you from this girl. Mm. She's imprisoned you. And so he kidnapped Larva and imprisoned him while he took out Miyu, because Lemuris thought if he eliminated Miyu, Larva would wake from her control. And then he was like, I'm a Shinma. Miyu will have cause to fight me. But a way to get around that, which is a good rules lawyering on his part, was to get a human spirit and have the human spirit fight Miyu, because she's not allowed to fight a human spirit, only Shinma. So anyway, this guy was dying. He was madly in love with his wife. They were poor or whatever. They had this suit of armor. And the wife was like, anything so that my husband can live again. So Shinma Lemuris was like, all right, I'll take your life and I'll grant spiritual life to your husband. And she was like, deal. So the husband saw this and was so overwhelmed with grief that he was like, I can't ever remember that at all. So he locked it away, and then Lemurus was like, oh, it's because you're a Shinma, and here, possess this suit of armor. Now you're an armor Shinma. You're not a human. You're an armor Shinma. So that's why Himiko can affect him, because she, as a spiritualist, she can affect a human ghost. But Miyu is not allowed to fight him because he's a human. And so that's why Miyu goes and gets
They got to work together.
Yeah, to come and help her. And it was cool. And then at the very end, the Shinma, the quote-unquote Shinma, is defeated and Larva is freed. And there are several key points in this episode where Miyu talks about her feelings about Larva. And then the first one is when he's imprisoned and she's talking with Himiko about it. And Himiko is like, how did you guys meet? Like, what's going on? And you get a little flashback about Miyu. And she was a little girl at the time. And Larva came from across the sea, because he was a leader of a clan of Shinma that defected from Japan and went to the West. And he came across the sea to join her, to be like, yes, I'm gonna be the leader of your people. And so the first thing he was gonna do was kill Miyu, because she was gonna be the next guardian.
Mm-hmm. Hold for siren.
Yeah, there's a nice fire truck going on. He was gonna kill Miyu because she was the next guardian. And so he was all set to do it, but then her vampire powers awakened and she hit him with the golden eyes, and he couldn't look away. She fed off him. And because he allowed that to happen, they sealed him and he became bonded to her.
So she can feed off of Shinma.
Yes.
And their blood as well.
Yeah, she can feed off of anything. It's just a question of what she chooses to.
Like Dexter, he can only kill other serial killers.
Yeah, exactly. And Miyu only wants to feed off of tortured souls. Although, interestingly, brief side note, Miyu, in the manga, there's a sequel kind of called Yui the Vampire Princess. And she also travels with a Shinma who is kind of her larva thing, but he openly is like, you can feed off me, because she refuses to feed off humans. And that's Yui, and that's, I don't know, I haven't read that one, but it's supposed to be pretty good. But anyway, Miyu feeds off him and gives him her blood too. And that's why Larva has the power of the flame, because he can banish Shinma as well, because he has also fed off Miyu, and then they have a bond together. So are they in love with each other or not? It's a very tough question, because Larva very, very clearly cares very, very deeply for her. And Miyu tells Himiko, she's like, he's my only friend. He's the only one who really understands me. He's my sole companion as I travel through this ageless wasteland. And when she was a child and freaking out, Larva would come and like wrap her in his cloak. And
it's almost like, you know, he symbolizes an imaginary friend.
Absolutely.
For a little girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like I said, the strong protector who's, mm-hmm. for one reason or another, not interested in sex.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting to me.
Yeah. It's like masculinity, all the strength that comes with that, but none of the threat of the penis.
Yeah. It's like dad, you know, like just.
But not.
But like protector.
Yeah.
You know, big brother, protector kind of thing, but not.
It's like the, what is it? The unoffensive male, or the un.
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. I mean, the whole theory of why are there some relationships with, you know, the straight woman and the gay man? Why does that relationship happen? Because it's like a man who won't hurt you. Gives you all the benefits of being with a man and being around masculine energy. But at the end of the day, he's not going to try to get in your pants.
Right. Which I guess is a real challenge for some people to deal with.
For women. Yeah. To feel like that's what all men, that's what men want.
I would imagine that if you're an attractive woman, you just have to deal with that so often that like anytime a guy comes and talks to you, you're just in the back of your mind, you're just kind of like, you're talking to me. Why? Is it because you actually are interested in me, or are you just trying to get my pants? And that's a tough thing. And I'm sure attractive men have to deal with it too.
It's tough too, because, not to completely sidetrack, but just going out and doing things, let's say, I was having this conversation with a friend the other day. It's like, I want to go out and dance, but I don't want to go out and dance by myself because I know someone's going to try to grind up on me, and I don't want to deal with that.
Right.
It's like the fact that that's like ingrained into just what you go through as a woman. Yeah,
dance clubs have become our society's kind of mating grounds, right? But yes, I understand. I guess that's, so then you could bring your male protector or whatever.
Yeah, like, right. So that's why this idea, you know, is a female for shoujo anime. And I would classify this as shoujo. It's like beautifully drawn men and women.
Very beautiful. The art on this is great.
Really exquisite.
It's 80s, but it's great.
And so as a woman audience watching the show, you take comfort in the idea of this man who is strong and powerful protect you, but is not going to try to be with you sexually.
Right. And also, I will say props to Larva. He backs off. He's, you know, whenever Miu is a very strong female character, I don't want to give the impression that she...
Larva does all the heavy lifting or anything like that.
Like, Miu can hold her own, like, for show. But they make a good team. At one point, Larva is freed. And this is the second point that Miu actually shows her feelings for Larva. She corners Lemuris and she says, I'm not going to banish you. Normally, for the past two episodes, she corners the Shinma and then banishes them to the dark, gets rid of them in the world. But she's like, but you, because you messed with my man Larva, I'm not going to banish you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to burn you to death. So she reduces him to ashes. Like, his immortal life is over. Shinma are immortal, unless there's an unnatural cause of their death. So she burns him to ash because
he... Don't mess with Larva.
Yeah, because he hurt Larva. Anyway, yeah, don't mess with Larva. And that to me bespeaks her real feelings for him, that she will kill for him.
Something that you said earlier, going back to the story of, you know, the man in the armored suit.
Sure.
It seems like a recurring theme through these episodes is a human being wanting to forget some difficult element of being human by transforming into a demon. And what is it trying to get at? And Miu, I think it's in episode 4, she has that speech about, or is it episode 3? She's like, I don't understand how these people forget, because I'll never forget.
Right. No, that's 3.
That's
the end of 3. Yeah, it's great. And like, Miu's whole thing as she's dealing with the suit of armor, he's like, hunt me. And she's like, I can't because you're human. And he's like, I'm not human. What are you talking about? And then she's like, you have to remember. Like, I can't fight you. You have to remember. Mm-hmm. And at the end, he does remember. And also, by the way, side note, this is the episode that introduced me to the concept of love suicide by the well, which is Shinju.
Uh-huh.
Because that's what the police think happened with the man and his wife. They're like, oh, it was Shinju. And
it's a very, very common theme in Japanese literature and society. This idea of the double suicide.
Which, you know, blew my mind. I was like, wow, to love someone so much that you would just die at the same time. On one hand, so romantic. And on the other one, just so messed up.
Such a downer.
Yeah. So anyway, I was introduced to this concept. But so the guy in the suit of armor, thanks to Miu's prompting and subsequent burning of Lemuris, who in his dying, Lemuris, while he's being burned alive and dying, talks with Larva, who is conscious apparently, but was imprisoned. And he's like, Larva, I love you so much. Like, I came to save you. And now you're staying with this girl.
That's
like,
right.
What's going on? And Larva's like, oh, Lemuris. And I've often pondered this line for years in my head and my spare time. He's like, Lemuris, if you could just understand this girl's sorrow, like, you would understand. And I was like, I just don't really get it.
You know,
like, what does draw Larva to Miu? I mean, obviously the blood bond, but like, is it just the fact that, you know, she has to endure this ageless thing while she hunts down all the stray Shinma, which we'll get into next episode? But
can I tell you my romantic interpretation of it?
I would be very open to it.
Because when I heard that, I thought, you know how there are some relationships where someone's with a person who's just very down or seems down all the time, and it's like, I love the way you hurt. Like, the way you feel things to me is so beautiful, and your sadness is so beautiful, and I want to be there for you through that. Like, it's
so
not a healthy relationship necessarily.
It reminds me of high school.
But, right, it's like, but what you fall in love with people aren't the ways they're perfect or amazing. What you really fall in love with are the ways they're broken, like you're broken. Mm. And so seeing each other's...
Oh, man, I'm going to write that down.
Yeah,
that's
you fall
great.
In love with people's flaws. That's what love really is, you know? It's like... So in a sense, that's kind of what I thought of when I heard that line, is like, if you could only see this, if you knew this girl's sorrow, like if you saw the way she is exquisitely broken, you would understand why I'm in her court.
That's heavy. Good one, Zara.
Deep moments with Zara.
Yeah, right. Hashtag deep moments with Zara. yeah, that's great.
So I don't know. That's what I thought.
Yeah, no.
Moving on.
Yeah, good one. No, I'm impressed.
Episode 4.
Yeah, I'm gonna get there in 1 second. Anyway, so...
Episode 3. Yeah. Summary.
We're wrapping it up. So anyway, once the armor realizes that he's human, he is facing a police squad who have seen him in his possessed armor. And Miu does something very interesting. She's like, you're human. You're going to be judged by humans. So that's it. Like, I'm out. So she steps out and the armor is like, wait, no, I am human. He remembers everything. He remembers his wife dying and stuff. And he's like, no, I'm human. And the police are like, open fire.
Yeah.
And they shoot him and he dies. It's very sad. It's a very sad thing.
And his blood is staining the snow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then it starts snowing. Yeah. And I was just like, man, this is a downer. But it was also so good.
And again, it's a shooting down of the traditional. So it's modernity versus traditional again.
Boom.
Coming up.
Yeah. Modern day machine guns. With the suit of armor being shot against, down. Yeah. Modern day machine guns against samurai armor. Man, Dara, you're rocking it today. 2 for 2. Anyway, I really like it. It's a somber one. It's not as uplifting as normal, but I liked it because you get to see a little bit of Miu's backstory and Larva's backstory with her, and the relationship between Himiko and Miu deepens. Okay, now, so that'll take us into number 4, which is spring. And
new beginnings.
New beginnings.
Or are they new?
Right. And this is probably, I don't know if it's my favorite, but it's definitely up there. It's a tie. A tie for being my favorite between number 2 and this one. Although I love number 1 so much. I can't really. I mean, it's like Sophie's Choice. But
wow.
I mean, it's heavy, man. Like every one of the, which one is best? Can I only pick one?
Oh, God.
I don't know. But anyway, in episode 4, it's springtime. Himiko is in
Kamakura, which is kind of the older part of Tokyo. It's just outside of Tokyo. So she likens it to, if Kyoto is the old capital, you know, in the Kansai region, and Kamakura is like Kanto's Kyoto. It's traditional. There's lots of shrines and temples. You know, it's rich. It's this, a lot of Japanese stories are set in Kamakura.
Oh, I didn't know any of that.
Mm-hmm. So it's very traditional and very conservative.
Is it like old town, Alec? Kind of like here's...
If I were to put it in terms of Washington, D.C., for all our DMV listeners out there...
Just so you know, I'm from the East Coast. We're actually both from the East Coast.
Well, I'm from Indiana, but I lived on the East Coast for a while.
Yeah, okay.
I'm from the East Coast in my heart of hearts.
Well, Indiana's pretty badass.
Is it? I don't know. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, okay. I enjoyed it. That's all I can say.
So if Washington, D.C. southwest, where all the monuments are, is Kyoto.
Sure.
Then I guess Kamakura might be like Old Town Alexandria, or Leesburg.
That's in Virginia, which is like totally Civil War.
Yeah, very Civil War.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Does that make sense?
Yeah,
does that
help? And it's great that I have you here to draw this comparison, because I had no idea. That line never made sense to me. I was just kind of like, all right, cool. But yeah, so I guess, and this is interesting to me. Miu was born there. Miu lived there. So she's, again, going back to your theme.
Wait, Himiko is from there.
Himiko stayed there as a child.
Okay.
But she's not from there.
Okay.
But Miu was... grew up there, and it goes back to your whole thing where if you want to go find the quote origin of Miu, quote, you go to the old way, the traditional way.
Yeah.
Himiko goes, I think she starts remembering things from her childhood, and she's like, I'm gonna go check it out, I've got some time off or whatever. So she goes to Kamakura.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she goes to Kamakura and she's like, yeah, I've been having this dream where I'm running up this hill, I think it was over here. And she goes there. And in her dream, at the top of the hill is a house. But she goes to the top of the hill and there's no house there. And she's like, oh, I guess it was a dream. But then poof. One of the things about Miu is she has her own dimension. Like Miu kind of hangs out in this dimension that's like...
Oh, yeah. We haven't talked about that.
Yeah.
But the eyeballs in the trees.
Yeah, yeah. And it's beautiful. It's grotesque and beautiful. It's like red and all the trees are silhouettes and they have these like orbs that are like eyes and kind of a Shinma realm. And she hangs out there with Larva when she's not in the real world. And she can also... use it to teleport. Like she'll leave a place and go into the dimension and then come out. She can exit in a different area and stuff like that. So Himiko goes to the top of the hill and there's no house. And then she turns around and all of a sudden she's absorbed into Miu's dimension, and there is a house. And so she turns back around, and there is a house, and now the house is in their reality or whatever. And she goes into the house, and it's this old school house, and in it is Miu, in this time a black kimono. Oh, I should also mention briefly for episode 3, Miu wore a winter kimono, which was slightly longer and thicker, which I just noticed as a...
Again, highlighting the seasonal shift of each episode.
Which I just loved. Well, I just love her outfits. They're great. But she's still barefoot, always. Anyway, in the fourth one, she's in this black kimono with, I think, white trim. Because Himiko meets her in the house and is like, what's going on? And she's like, you can open this door. And she opens the door. And in this really, really interesting yet simple visual effect, it's Miu's parents upside down behind glass or ice or something. The entire room has been filled as if it was a block of ice.
And yeah, panes of glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or glass. And the parents are upside down. The parents are upside down, immobilized in it. And that was an amazing visual to me as well. I highly recommend the visuals. But through that, Himiko is like, what the F is going on? Like, this is crazy. And so Miu, in a rare moment of humanity, is like, all right, I'll tell you my backstory. Mm-hmm. And let's go into it. And she explains that her mother was a Shinma who married her father, who was a human. And her mother was a vampire who was one of the guardians, that the rules about the vampires being the guardians of the Shinma had already been in place. And except they were mortal. The vampires would grow old and die. But as a payoff for making that sacrifice in order to guard the Shinma, they were removed from all vampire restrictions. And this kind of goes, you can see elements of it throughout the entire series, but like Miu is not affected by holy water. She's not mm-hmm. affected by sunlight. She's not affected by
and
crucifix.
And Himiko gets frustrated about this. Yeah. She's like, what kind of vampire are you? You don't react to garlic, holy, right. You know, garlic, holy water,
yeah.
All these things.
Crucifix.
Who no. are you?
Yeah. What kind of monster are you? It's
Who
so good.
Who are you?
Yeah. It's, not the dough. But yeah, it's so good. Miu reveals that after Larva awakened her vampire blood, she was a small girl. I think she was like 13 or something. And she went home and her mom was like, hey, anything happened? You were late coming home today. And she was like, oh no, nothing. I just wanted to watch the waves or whatever. And Miu's dad is a human that Miu's mom made immortal because she loved him so much. But the trade-off of it is once he lost his mortality, he became disinterested in everything because
he
he's
lost
like
his self, what made him his essence.
He was just like, I have enough time to do anything. It doesn't matter. Like nothing matters anymore. I'm immortal. And that tore Miu's mom up because she was like, I made him immortal because I thought it would help. But instead he's just bored out of his mind all the time. And there's nothing I can do about it. One of the central themes of Miu's anime is immortality everything it's cracked up to be? Everyone says they want eternal life, but is it really worth it? And is it right to give it to somebody? Mm-hmm. And I had never even remotely thought about these questions before because and to be fair, I was a huge sci-fi geek and a fantasy geek, and these were heavy questions to me and very, very interesting to me. So I props to Miu. It really kind of reorientated my thought about what's right, what's wrong, what's a good price for something. Like it's a very mature anime in the best sense.
Without nudging you too strongly in either direction. Like it doesn't say, you know, this is the way, she's right, or no, she's right.
Yeah.
It's like you can see why people made the choices they made.
Right.
And still think, oh, maybe I would have made a different choice.
Yeah,
maybe I wouldn't have.
I think, I agree with you. I think what it does is essentially present both sides of the coin. And it's just like, hey, viewer, up to you. Bam, peace, drop the mic. Like, we're out. So that's an interesting thing to me. But played against this backdrop is Miu's burgeoning
power.
Yeah, vampire-ness, which is coming up. And what ends up happening is Larva awakens her bloodlust in her, and then she starts becoming a vampire, and she doesn't understand what's going on. And the next day at school, she attacks a girl and drains her, and the girl ends up dying. And Miyu doesn't really understand what's going on, and she's freaking out about it. And she goes home, and the mom is like, "Hey, I hear like someone passed out from anemia today." And she's like, "Yeah, yeah, she just passed out." And the mom was like,
"The girl died."
Yeah, I heard she died. And Miyu's like, "Oh,
I didn't mean to kill her."
Yeah. Well, she doesn't say that, but then she runs to the room, and she's got this bird. She's got this little bird that she like tries to be cool about. but she ends up killing the bird. I can't remember why. But anyway, in the meantime, she's getting consumed with
bloodthirst.
And in one of the coolest scenes, in my opinion, a friend of Miyu's from school, Akiko.
Homo erratus.
Yeah. I'll debate that with you. I'm very curious about your... I mean, wasn't that just take my blood? I mean, we'll talk about it. Mm. But
she had a lacy undershirt on. Sorry.
I mean, yes, if you're into 12-year-old girl undergarments.
Which I am not.
Clearly.
Anyway. Neither should you be unless you're 12.
Right. Or 11.
Or 11. All the time.
But anyway, Akiko comes over for a play date. And Miyu is like, "Do you want to have tea?" And then all of a sudden, Akiko's like, "You know, ever since that girl passed out, I've been thinking a lot about mortality." And then she's like, "I saw you. I saw you drain that girl." And Miyu's like, "Oh!" And then she's, "I saw you drain that girl. Is it true that vampires can give immortality? And if it is, do it.
Do it to me."
Yeah. And Miyu is very torn. And she's like, "No, no, no, I can't. But then Akiko kind of opens her shirt and bares her neck or whatever, and Miyu like sees the neck, and she's like, and her eyes go gold, and then that's it. And they do this great thing where she comes closer and the mouth opens, and Miyu has a small mouth because it's big eyes small mouth style anime, but it like you see the mouth open and you're like, oh man, it's gonna happen. And then all of a sudden her mom shows up
and slaps her.
Yeah, that's great. And Miyu is like,
and
oh,
then,
oh, this is the best.
This, so anyway, yeah.
Oh, do you want to talk?
Well, no,
talk?
No, continue.
Okay. So then it immediately cuts to Miyu in her room, and she's like, "Oh, I don't know what's happening and stuff, and I'm really sorry." And her mom shows up, and she's like, "Mom, I'm a vampire." And she's like, "No, you're human." But then she whips out this glass of blood.
Of blood.
Yeah. And she's like,
"Just drink this.
Just drink this. It's the last time because you're human." And Miyu is like, "What? Where did this no?" And then I think she flashes back, and like,
well, she like touches the blood and she has a sense of where the blood's right, from. You're thinking, yeah, like cow blood, you get it at the butcher, right, pig blood,
right. But no, she touches the blood and then like it flashes back, and it's Akiko who's like about to leave, and the mom like grabs
her hand.
And then she turns back and she's like, "Mom, this is Akiko's blood, isn't it? It's Akiko's blood.
You killed her."
And the mom is just like, "Get up and leave."
Yeah. So, says nothing. Closes the door.
No response.
And she tries to resist drinking the blood, but then like it cuts to the parents outside, and then it cuts to her, and you see that there's a couple drops that fall from her mouth as she's drained the glass.
Yeah, and then she throws the empty glass.
Disgusted with herself. Oh, a little bit.
Yeah, beating herself up tremendously. Like can't stand to be with herself. But it's interesting because later in the episode, so the Shinma come. I'm not exactly sure what's going on here, but like the Shinma show up and they're like, it's time to declare a new guardian, and it's going to be Miyu. And for some reason, the mom is like, "No, I want her to live a human life, so I'll defend you." So they both leave the dad, who gets immediately surrounded by Shinma and subsequently, who knows. And then they're on the run, and the Shinma corner them. And Miyu can't run. They're running and Miyu can't run because she can't breathe because she's so thirsty. And so at that point, the mom is like, "Well, I'll defend you." But then Miyu's bloodlust takes over and she feeds from her mom.
Which to me, I did not see coming, but I thought was so cool.
Yeah, no, it's unreal.
And I also wonder if the mom knew that was going to happen and that's why they went out together.
No,
or the mother offered herself to her in a sense, or just knew it was coming? You think that the mother had no idea?
I think the mother had no idea. I think the mother was like, "I have to save my baby girl. We're running. Like, your dad's a lost cause, but we're running. We're going to make it. And if they come after me, I'll defend you." But then Miyu can't keep up. So she's like, "Oh, Miyu, like, come on, you have to do it," or whatever. And then again, what happens is Miyu's eyes turn gold and it hits her mom. And her mom's like, Oh no. And then I think it's this wonderful moment of decision where like your point as a parent is to nurture and keep your child alive and safe. And Miyu can't breathe at this point because her throat is closing up from thirst. So I think her mom comes to this like peace where she's like,
peace with it.
Yeah, my point is to give my life for my child. Mm-hmm. Like, I was going to do that either way.
Ah, and this is the way it needs to be done.
Yeah, so then she's like, all right, me, you take it. Do it so that you can live. Like, and that's kind of a theme in a lot of anime where they're like, I'll die, but you live. I want you to live.
Right, and that's why I thought maybe it was pre-planned or pre...
Oh, I don't think it was pre-planned because I think the plan was to run until they were away and deal with it later.
Like, but then when it was happening, being okay with it, realization, like, okay.
Yeah.
I understand.
Yeah. And so this goes back into her beautiful agony type thing where Miu comes out of her bloodlust.
Exquisite sorrow.
Exactly. And realizes that she has killed her mom. Well, fed from her mom to the point of, at the very least, incapacitation.
Yeah.
Freaks out. Larva comes. They, you know, they kind of do a little bonding. He shelters her, whatever. But the Shinmen catch up with them and basically say, you really messed up because you broke away from us and got us distracted hunting you down. A bunch of Shinma escaped. Your deal now is you are immortal. So we're removing you from the mortality. And your parents are imprisoned in this like glass block. And you are immortal until all the other Shinma that were released.
So that's her motivation.
Yeah, for have been returned to the dark, which I assume includes Larva, question mark? I don't know.
Oh, that's an
interesting...
Good,
yeah,
maybe he's the final piece. Free the genie, so
right,
to speak.
Right, sure. Yeah. Also, her parents will be restored to her, so maybe she'll have a happy life or something. So yeah, and that's episode 4, and it's a wonderful journey into Miu's backstory. Now... do you want to take it? The big twist?
Well, yeah. I don't know that I... Okay, this is what I... As a first-time viewer, having seen the episode once, this is my perspective of what happened.
Yeah.
So Miu tells this story to Himiko. And then Himiko, at one point, turns? Or does this happen? She goes and the house is not there. Is that the very, very end?
It's both at the beginning. When she first arrives, it's not there. And then at the very end, she leaves. And then she turns around. It's gone.
Again. Yeah. Yeah. But... Himiko has a flash to when she lived there in Kamakura in that house, and she
in a different house.
In a different house,
she was playing ball or something.
Yeah, and she had opened a screen, and
Himiko was playing ball. She was playing with a ball, which is kind of a theme because Miu plays with these orbs. Anyway, and she goes up the hill to where the house is, and she loses control of the ball, and the ball rolls away. So she goes to get the ball, and at that point. So whoever's in the house, which
opens.
We assume is Miu, maybe, opens the screens. And whatever happened at that point, Himiko, like, can't remember. It's too freaky.
Right. Remembers she didn't turn away. She, like, looked, she went.
She was transfixed.
She was transfixed.
Yeah.
So it leads you to question, okay, Miu and Himiko have met before. Did Miu feed on Himiko? And is that why, part of the reason why she has these powers with spirituality?
Yeah. And there's a lot of leading lines that throughout the entire OVA series, if you look for them, they're there where she's like, humans always think that. With clouded eyes and tainted lips. Miu says these lines. And she's like, a lot of people think one thing, even though the truth is always within them. And especially in
Bruce Willis.
Yeah, exactly. And especially in the fourth episode, Miu turns to Himiko when they're first in the house together. And Miu's eyes turn gold. And Himiko is unaffected. And she's like, what are you doing? Get away. And Miu actually says, oh, that explains a lot. You know, people always think these things, even though the truth is always within them. And then she goes on this thing and she's like, you know, sometimes when people are bitten, it doesn't manifest until later. They grow and they grow older and everything. And then one day it wakes up And so, yeah, I think the very heavy implication when Himiko was a child, when she was like 5 or whatever, younger Miu, who was already a vampire at that point, came across her. Fed from her and then either gave her some of her own blood and or the feeding of it awakened these spiritual powers in Himiko. And so they are in fact like
linked.
Super linked in some way, which as a viewer when I was watching it blew my mind.
Yeah.
I was just like, I didn't even see it coming. How could you?
And which is why I was shocked when I watched the OVA. And then to learn that that's the only place Himiko appears?
Yeah.
Like, what a waste of an amazing character.
Yeah.
Like, and a build-up. And I want to know more about that.
I do too. I think a lot of I highly recommend you watch it. If you watch it, you'll probably want to know too. I think it's a waste that they didn't pursue that storyline, but instead they went off on the
bunny demon storyline.
Yeah, that's TV series. We'll have another one about the TV series, but which is radically different. Same creative team that did the OVAs.
10 years later.
10 years later, very different outcome, very different story, very different tone. In my opinion, and we can get into a debate about that. But that's it. Overall, it's one of my favorite animes. I highly, highly recommend anybody who gets a chance to check it out. It is available online for order. It's on DVD.
It's short. It's 4 episodes, 23 minutes each or so.
And it's just
easy to watch. Really good for its creepiness factor.
Yeah, great October viewing. Like, great for a Halloween party or whatever. And also just good drama. Just great drama, gets you thinking, makes you wonder like what's happening in the world and your relationships with people and stuff like that. And it's just good characters, good storytelling, great storytelling. I highly recommend it. Zara, final impressions.
Well, I guess.
Or any questions or anything? I don't know.
Nah, no questions. I guess it made me, coming away from this, it made me walk away with more questions than I had answers, which I love. Not always is that an effective strategy in a show, cough, cough, Lost. But for this show, I love coming away with these questions. And even though, you know, I'm irritated that the Himiko character is not really explored further, I come away intrigued and wondering about her. And so that's, to me, the mark of good art and good horror, specifically, when you're left with questions and the characters kind of live on in your head and haunt you for days to come.
Or years, in my case.
Or years.
I have been thinking about Miyu in the back of my mind. It's one of my biggest influences as a filmmaker. Just for decades. For decades, I've been like, how could I accomplish something like Miyu? It's fascinating stuff. Anyway, if you get a chance, fantastic stuff. I highly recommend you check it out. Buy it, rent it, whatever you can. Get it. This is it is available, and it's available legally. So get it and check it out. And also, if you get a chance, check out Meltdown Comics, who is providing us with this podcast, which is great. And Zara, where can we hear more of your glorious voice?
Oh, you can hear me at zarafuzzle.com. What am I doing right now?
That.
Currently, ZERAFAZAL. .com. Nice. I'm currently working a bunch of commercial projects across the country. If you live in Arkansas or Texas, you might hear me regularly on your radio or TV.
You gotta get me a sample.
Oh, totally.
I'll totally do it. But you're a phenomenal voice actress. You're a wonderful actress.
Thanks, Mason.
She's just rocking it out here in Hollywood. It's good times. Check out our website, and you will be glad you did. And otherwise, thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for listening.
We'll be back again next week for more anime addict stuff.
Bye. Stay safe. Yeah. Avoid vampires.
'So, thanks for listening. Check out Meltdown Comics, 7522 Sunset Boulevard. Big thanks to them for letting us record. And if you have any questions or comments, you can hit us up on Instagram at AnimeAtticLove and Twitter at AnimeAtticLove. And give us some thoughts, some feedback, and any shows that you'd like us to do. Just hit us on up. So that's it. And thanks for listening. Catch you next week.